This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is August 12th, 2021, and this is episode 252.
I'm Scott Lundebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we continue digging into the nonpartisan premiers in the greatest BC premier bracket. But one thing none of those men ever became was prime minister, and the federal prime minister, Justin Trudeau, looks set to finally kick off the long-expected snap election. The rumors seem like it's going to happen this week. I'll be in Ottawa. I'm not going to go look and see if it happens in person, but I could. Thanks for listening. And thanks everyone who's contributing. Keep this show going. We love your support. It helps make us do fun things like launch brackets of the greatest premier and spend time looking up obscure people who led the province for 3 months, as apparently many people did. So thank you all for signing up. You can join them at patreon.com/politicoast. Let's jump straight into the greatest BC premier bracket rather than switch to any of the more colorful, by that I mean of partisan colors, premiers. I figured we'd burn through a few more nonpartisan premiers just to bring their numbers down into the realm of where the rest of the corners of our bracket are. So we're going into the quarterfinals. And as we go through and set up each of these different contests for today, we'll let you know who won the first round. So thank you to everyone who voted. This only happens because you pick people you think are better premiers. That, or maybe they're just names that sounded more familiar at this point. Eventually, we'll get to the people you really know and really care about. But who knows? Maybe one of these men, they're all men, is the greatest premier we ever had, and we just never realized it. In the first face-off, we had John Foster McCrate versus John Robson. John McCrate was the first premier of BC, but did not manage to come out ahead. He lost to John Robson by a single vote. Every vote does matter, folks. 19-18, John Robson was a better premier to that many people. So John Robson's going to be facing off against, no surprise, Amor de Cosmos, Blue, Edward, I can't even remember his name, Edward Gawler Pryor, a whopping 41-3 votes. I can't even remember what Pryor did, so it tells you why more people picked de Cosmos.
He's definitely the most amusingly eccentric, I think, of probably all of the premiers, so no surprise
De Cosmos,
there.
Not Pryor.
Yes.
So let's talk about John Robson first, a little bit more. We talked a bit about all these premiers in the last episode. We'll talk a little bit more each time we visit them and try to cover something different about them. John Robson, I think, is actually pretty interesting because at his time, he was an advocate and he became an advocate, especially as premier and in his later years in politics, for women's suffrage. He actually wanted to give the women of BC the right to vote. Now, he restricted that largely to white women, because he also passed an amendment to disenfranchise Chinese and Indigenous people. But there was at least some recognition that women should have the right to vote. And for 1885, that's ahead of his time. He also recognized and said at one point that Indigenous people had were the original, quote, lords of the soil. But nevertheless, he still sought to restrict the amount of land they could use, because he, like many of his contemporaries, didn't think Indigenous people were as efficient a farmer as white settlers who were coming in. So Robson was a interesting person in a few different ways, ahead of his time on some ways. Like, he really wanted a secular education system, or at least a nonpartisan, in that it would represent all Christians, because he didn't want godless schools. You got to still start with the Lord's Prayer, but they should at least be non-sectarian.
Which, kind of, once again, progressive for the time.
Yeah. Still promoting a certain kind of hegemony, but like less, a more heterogeneous white hegemony. De Cosmos had largely similar views in terms of the racism of all of others at this time, but just as you mentioned, just an utterly fascinating person. His birth name was William Alexander Smith. And there's this anecdote where when he was first trying to run for election in some of the colonial periods, he lost his first race and he ran in a by-election, but he couldn't run as Amor de Cosmos for, you know, whatever reason of bureaucracy. And so the name on the ballot at the time was William Alexander Smith, commonly known as Amor de Cosmos. And I guess you had to stand up and recite that full title exactly. And the fact one voter failed to say William Alexander Smith, commonly known as Amor de Cosmos, perfectly, de Cosmos lost that vote. Secret ballots are helpful.
Written ballots are helpful too. That is not a great strategy.
Yeah. De Cosmos wasn't actually that notable as premier. I guess like he was only premier for a year and a half. He spent much of his time in Ottawa and London, didn't pass many bills. One interesting thing is, I guess the first premier, McCrate, had this practice of having the lieutenant governor sit in on cabinet meetings. And this was Joseph Trutch at the time, noted like uber racist, who was eager to tear up even the treaties that BC and Canada had signed with Indigenous people here. So De Cosmos said, maybe the representative of the crown shouldn't sit in on our responsible cabinet government. Like, we're separate from the government, or we're separate from the crown in terms of how our governments are supposed to operate. So good step there. You have any thoughts on the Robson versus De Cosmos?
Robson does sound like he had more of an impact, but is definitely less of a colorful figure, shall we say. So it'll be interesting to see if this one ends up coming down to style or substance.
Yeah, for me, as I read more about it, De Cosmos is more just like this eccentric character of BC's history who like fell into being premier, but once he was out of the office, he was just a crank and he was eventually committed to a mental institution. It's hard to actually say, like, he did write a lot in the pre-premier time about reform and joining, and set out a number of ideas that were taken up by the later leaders. But as a politician, I don't know that De Cosmos was that effective. Fancy name and quite the style. Maybe he'll take out John Robson, who's definitely more of a heavyweight than Pryor. In our next round, we actually have another super close vote. We had George Anthony Walkham versus John Herbert Turner. This one came down as well to a single vote with Walkham. I think Turner was initially up, but then Walkham came ahead right at the end and won it 17-16. It was a tight race. Both have their arguments for him. I think that was one of the best balanced ones. And in the other battle, we had Andrew Charles Elliott versus Charles Augustus Semlin, ended up winning that one 19-13. And now we have the Walkham versus Semlin battle. Do you want to walk us through? Walkham us through?
Ooh, that is bad. You need to bring your dad joke game up just a little bit.
Not that much.
Definitely more above where it is now. Let's at least settle on that. Yeah, so Walkham, I think as we mentioned last time, took over from De Cosmos after De Cosmos resigned. And yeah, had to deal with the fallout from the Tet Seda scandal when De Cosmos tried to start up our own kind of steel industry in a somewhat corrupt way on Tet Seda Island. But he ultimately concluded there wasn't enough evidence for charges to pursue against that. And otherwise, his main legacy was a racial voting law that denied Chinese and Indigenous people.
Someone had to pass the first one, so it ended up being Walkham. It was interesting. Walkham, it sounds like, because he was premier as Joseph Trutch, who I mentioned, was the lieutenant governor, and Trutch was keen to just tear up treaties and destroy Aboriginal title as quickly as he could. And Walkham, like many, were sympathetic to that, but I think wasn't as extreme and did see some title and existence of that right there. And land claims were and continue to be a challenge for governments in BC. But I guess one of the anecdotes is that Walkham and Trutch's discussions around this, he didn't want them being aired publicly, lest it, I don't know, engender sympathy to the Indigenous causes, or at least even acknowledge that the claims of British Columbia were not as solid as I think the government wishes they were, which thankfully had no knock-on effects for the next 150 years of the province.
So Semlin was another one of these short-serving premiers appointed by McInnes after Bevin had turned down the job, like we discussed last time. His time was somewhat rocky, having to deal with the goings-on shenanigans by his Attorney General Martin that, you may remember, caused a riot in the Kootenays. And then, finally, the item note, here's he was the last surviving member of the first BC legislature and lived until 1927.
Yeah, I tried to find more on Semlin, but he had a really rough go of it. Like, even his appointment was not clean, given that the lieutenant governor at the time was like, actually, I'm going to go ask Robert Bevan, who we'll talk about in a second, who's not an MLA at the time. And there's rumors it was because Bevan was promising McInnes's son or family members a cabinet position, but that didn't pan out. So,
yeah, that would make sense if he then just turned down the job and offer.
Yeah. So I feel like this one isn't as close as some of the others. Semlin had a less difficult go in the first round, but can he take down George Anthony Walkham? I don't know. Next up, we had our infamous, we did it once, but the Battle of the Fake Premiers, Robert Bevan versus Joseph Martin. As mentioned in the last one, Martin became premier after Semlin went down, and Martin ultimately was the premier who lost a non-confidence vote 28-1 or something like that, pretty close to that, versus Bevan only lost it 16-8. But Bevan defeated Martin 20-9. Probably because of the wanting to make Vancouver Island its own kingdom. That makes you pretty memorable.
That is just such like bald, kind of balled out awesome idea.
Especially when you have no mandate.
He's kind of wild. Yeah, no mandate, just completely wild. Like, may not have been like wise government, but it is definitely probably the most fun of any of the bullet points here, with the possible exception of some of the Cosmos's antics.
And in the other contest, we had William Smythe versus James Dunsmuir. Smythe ultimately won that 20-15. Excuse me. As I mentioned, Bevan was only premier for 6 months. It was not a good time. It was not a long time, at least, but it seems like he had a good time. After being defeated in provincial politics, he went on to become mayor of Victoria in 1892 and had to win again in 1893. But he was defeated in 1894, but came back in 1896 and lost in 1897. So if you think municipal politics is a bit crazy, if you think municipal politics is a bit wild these days, imagine if you had elections every year. For more, check out the Cambie Report. We'll have new episodes later this month and going into the election next year.
Yeah, early democracy is weirdly that. It kind of reminds me of, what is it? Did the Romans elect a new consul every year or so? Or a pair of consuls every year?
Maybe time just went slower in the past. Feels like it goes fast now. Yeah. I don't know.
Or when you're like, what would at that time be a pretty small town? Because Victoria was not exactly the city it is today.
Yeah, it's kind of like your nonprofit board elections every year.
Yeah, smaller the place, I think easier it may be to run more frequent elections. Is it really any crazier than the U.S. Congress having two-year election cycles?
Fair enough. In his later life, Bevan was also a spokesperson for working class views. He advocated for the 8-hour workday, and as was popular at the time, the idea that businesses could exclude Chinese workers from having to hire them. So both labor progressive and also racist, as seemed to be common.
Those two things did go together quite a bit in the early labor movement.
Coming up against Bevan is William Smythe. Smythe actually was the premier after Bevan and managed to assemble the largest majority since Confederation. He inherited a bunch of unfinished issues, like the railway hadn't been finished. There was this ongoing scandal around the Esquimalt dock construction, which was just getting out of hand and felt like the province couldn't afford it. And there were demands for a railway to connect Victoria and Nanaimo, something people still want. Well, they had for quite a while, but they would like again. Smythe actually was pretty successful at solving many of these. He reached a deal with John A. Macdonald to get the railway finished and did so by doing a huge land transfer to the feds, which meant BC didn't have to pay any cash, We have all this land. It may have been stolen, but we can transfer it to John A. MacDonald, who doesn't care who you took it from. This was also the period when the deal that meant the CP Railway was going to end in Port Moody got changed to go to Vancouver, and it screwed over a bunch of speculators in favor of other speculators, as is a time-honored tradition in BC land speculation.
Yeah, yeah. The current speculation questions are hardly new in this province. It is an interesting what if about how Metro, I guess, Port Moody would have shaped out if that had remained the original railhead, or I guess if New Westminster had remained the provincial capital. Like, the area here could have been quite different. Vancouver would be some like small suburb of Port Moody,
and here where I am near Coquitlam Town Center, it would be a bustling downtown core.
You'd be in the downtown of the region, or maybe it would have been like a, you know, a twin cities thing where you had kind of one built up area around New West and another in Port Moody. It's an interesting thing about.
And as we mentioned last week, Smythe also passed a bunch of racist laws against Indigenous and Chinese people. He was very popular and won the 1886 election, but he died in 1887. So was not able to keep governing for significant longer. He was not an old man either when he died.
He was only
47, I believe. So that's William Smythe. And finally, the two nonpartisan premiers we didn't meet in last week's episode were the Davy brothers, Alexander Edmund Baston Davy and Theodore Davy. Do you want to tell us about Alexander?
Yeah, so he was the 8th premier from April 1st, 1887 to August 1st, 1889. Before that, he was the AG to Smythe and argued before the Supreme Court of Canada in favor of the provincial right to regulate liquor sales. Is that even an issue? It seems pretty constitutionally clear. I don't recall liquor being in, Section 91?
I don't know if liquor was explicitly written into the British North America Act or the Constitution Act, but if it was, then it must have been an easy case for Alexander Davy. Unfortunately for Davy's premiership, he fell ill fairly quickly after becoming premier and decided to relocate to California to try to recover and let John Robson do most of the day-to-day governing.
So he was one of the original
snowbirds? Yeah, kind of a Brian Pallister of his day.
Although I guess in that case, I guess they'd be snowboaters. Can't really fly.
A cattle train or something. Just march down there. Alexander did return to BC in 1888 while he was still ill, but he died later that year in August. One of two or three premiers in a row who passed away in office. No notable accomplishments. Maybe he's better than his brother. Theodore, who was the 10th premier from July 2nd, 1892 to March 2nd, 1895. He was also an attorney general, this time to Premier Robson. He passed a redistribution bill. These were quite common at the time as the population was changing pretty quickly to give more seats to the mainland. He also tried to incentivize the railway to stimulate the economy. We have him to thank, Theodore Davy, for the construction of the Parliament buildings. He approved that final blueprints bill despite the pressure to move the capital to the mainland. So if you wish the capital BC was in New Westminster, blame Theodore Davy for constructing a building that meant we could never leave.
He only gets part of the blame because the original decision, that was when the colonies unified in the 1860s, so he just didn't reverse it.
Yeah, fair enough. Theodore decided to give up being premier in 1895 when he got the chance to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of BC. He succeeded Sir Matthew Begbie, now known as the Hanging Judge, who...
I think it was known by that at the time, too.
I was reading a few things that it was later that he became known as that. Okay. But infamously executed a number of Indigenous chiefs who led some revolts and uprisings against prospectors in the interior during skirmishes over whose land it was. Yeah, Theodore versus Alexander, our final battle of the quarterfinals of the nonpartisan premiers. Go vote at politicos.ca/bracket. The links will be in the show notes and on Twitter. You have at least a week to do this. I'll be away next week, so we'll figure out what's happening in the bracket next week.
From past first ministers, let's switch gears to who may or may not be our next first minister, this time federally, as we move on to our second segment, and they're almost off. So the long-anticipated election appears to finally be around the corner, as multiple media sites today were reporting that Trudeau is planning on calling an election this Sunday for the voting date of September 20th.
That's basically it, right? We've been talking about this for so long. We thought it might happen last week. It didn't. Now it seems like it will almost assuredly happen this weekend. It's a formality at this point.
It does feel like that. Although I am going to feel a little better when they finally call it, because that means my prediction at the start of the year that there wouldn't be a spring election, but it would be a fall one, is going to get scored as a win. Even though I really don't want there to be election, and like not super thrilled about it. It feels a bit unnecessary, but nevertheless, we are doing it because, you know, this is just one of the joys of the Westminster system, is first ministers just get to call them.
Yeah, just sighs. So not every Liberal MP, though, is eager to return to Parliament. There have been a couple announcements this week of relatively high-profile members of Parliament who are not seeking re-election. First up is, I believe it's Toronto MP Adam Vaughan?
Yes, Toronto MP. Former Toronto City Councillor before making the jump to federal politics. He was also the government's point person on the housing file and basically decided to do that job by spending a lot of time on Twitter arguing with people about housing and slinging some of the worst housing takes I've seen. So not exactly going to be missed by pretty much anyone under 40 who doesn't own a home.
Yeah, but we will miss Will Amos and his...
Will we, though?
No, it's a good distraction to talk about, or at least have a chuckle about the guy who repeatedly appeared naked on Zoom calls. The first one, you can say that's an honest mistake. We shouldn't share those images. It's improper. The second one, though, it's like, dude, you should know. You should know. That's all we really have to say about Will Amos. He's not going to run again, but he had a sordid and short career now.
Yes, I had not heard of him prior to the first naked committee appearance.
He was initially elected in October 2015, though, and he did serve from December 2019 as the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Innovation, Science, and Industry. He was previously a lawyer for EcoJustice. So hopefully he can go back to his roles there and advance the cause. But
I guess, does EcoJustice have a less formal dress code?
It's so unfortunate that half his Wikipedia entry is now about, quote, on-camera incidents. Anyway, that wasn't the only thing leaking out recently, as it's not even clear if this was a leak or an intentional early release, but the NDP platform is out when we're not even officially in an election.
Yeah, this was a bit of a surprise. I think didn't in 2019 they put out like a pre-election policy statement kind of thing. I seem to remember talking about that. But this time it looks like they've dropped their full platform. And like you said, it's a little unclear. I think everyone first started, I shouldn't say everyone, because 15% of the country uses Twitter, but people started seeing it floating around Twitter, not on the official NDP website, before the NDP formally pushed it out like an hour or so later today, which has definitely led to some speculation that it was a leak. But regardless, nobody's said one way or the other. Doesn't really make a lot of sense from my perspective to put it out ahead of time, both because Trudeau could mess with you and not actually call the election this weekend, and it just doesn't strike me as a great political strategy to put all your eggs and whatnot. I'm missing my metaphor. Basically push everything out ahead of time and have all your big policy announcements lose their newsworthiness before anyone's actually paying attention in the election.
So that's the traditional strategic plan and approach. And typically, I think that's a fair and reasonable approach. But I think there's, especially if you're not the front runner party, if you're not the one people are paying the most attention to and going, what's the next big thing they're going to talk about, like Trudeau and probably O'Toole, you need to try a few different methods. A lot of stuff in this platform is re-announcements, right? The NDP, all the parties have been doing policy announcements for the last year or more, especially in the last 3-6 months. So we know what they're going to be talking about. Like, we knew some of the NDP stuff on housing. We knew their stuff on student loans. We know that they like a foreign buyers tax and a wealth tax and those kind of things. None of that is surprising. There's not actually a lot surprising in here. Even though it's 115 pages, there's not actually a lot in here in general. It's a lot of buzzwords, weirdly.
Very underwhelming.
So short on specifics. But in terms of, should you put out your full policy document early? One of the things I think this lets the NDP do is energize their base, assuming it's exciting to their base. So ignore the content for a second. It's a strategy I think works in a more grassroots, decentralized kind of approach, whether it's like the approach Jeremy Corbyn's tried to take in at least one election, some of the stuff.
How did that work out for him?
It was the largest increase in votes the Labour Party has ever gotten. It wasn't enough to win.
Still didn't win, though.
But it was,
they did lose
it
that
was
election.
One of those cases where it was like, they were going to get fully blown out of the water. And I think they held May to a minority in that case, at least.
Yeah, on that election, May just did so much wrong. Like, it's more her fault for losing the seats on an election she called opportunistically.
But it's one of those things where people started talking about the manifesto there. And they can, if there's meat here, and I'm a little worried there isn't, it gives people the chance to start thinking about it and really frame it. And you don't have to, because we all know they're going to put the platform out. Now, I agree they probably should have waited until the election had actually been called, but I guess if it's a leak, it's a leak. Dropping it on a Friday, what day is it even? Thursday. Jesus, Thursday. I'm so tired. About to go on vacation.
The day we normally record.
So I don't think it's a terrible strategy. I think next week would have been better.
Yeah, I'd be more sympathetic to this is going to rile up our base and get them excited. I don't know, there's more meat here. And I don't know, maybe I'm not the target NDP voter. I'm not thrilled. 16 new national strategies for everything isn't exactly the sort of thing that makes me want to run to the ballot box.
Yeah,
I counted. There are actually 16. Yeah, no, it's a little bit much. It's a lot of stuff like just, this is a problem area. We'll have a national strategy for it paired with kind of the traditional NDP stuff, the thing that's been in their platform for 30 years or more. Yes, they want dental care. They want pharma care.
They want electoral reform, but they don't even say how or what kind. Did it say it explicitly? Okay, I tried to read through and it just said, we will make every vote count, is what I saw.
It's not highlighted, so they bold a bunch of things, but not that. It was underwhelming.
So like to compare it to that Labour manifesto I alluded to, that one was bold. That one was like, we're going to renationalize railways. We're going to bring in a bill that can change corporate structures so workers have seats on boards. Like things that were quite radical relative to where the politics had been, and that makes you pay attention whether you agree with them or not. There's nothing in here that's radical.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the rail thing, because that was something that really jumped out at me. The thing the NDP likes to do is accuse the Liberals of stealing all their ideas. Here, the other thing is happening where the NDP is taking a pretty kind of middling Liberal policy and running on that specifically for rail. You know, you'd expect the NDP to want a big kind of, I guess, a national rail strategy as their forte or idiom would be, but instead they just want a high frequency rail in the Quebec Windsor corridor, which is the thing the Liberals announced a couple weeks back and is just, yeah, I guess it's better than the current Via Rail, but is running more trains more often really that big a win for a transformative, we need to take climate change super seriously and everything platform?
Maybe they're leaving themselves space to announce more things during the platform or during the election itself, and that's the compromise. I would hope so, but yeah, it would be weird.
I mean, possibly,
like, they haven't put the costing in here. There are no numbers to anything.
Yeah, and there are definitely a few things that'll cost quite a bit, in addition to like all the, you know, typical NDP transfer programs that they want, the various pharmacare, dental, all that stuff. There's also promise to require retrofits of every building in Canada between now and 2050, which I'll give them this, that is bold. But they don't say how they're going to go about it, and that's either going to cost the government a huge amount of money, or it's going to put the onus on just a lot of regular Canadians to undertake some very expensive renovations on their own dime. And it's either way, that's going to be politically quite challenging once you actually get to the implementation questions on that.
So there you have it. We have the NDP platform in our hands. We'll await the Liberal and the Conservative. And maybe the Greens will even get a platform together. I have no clue if they could have that capacity at this point in time.
At this point, just stop suing each other.
What a bold election strategy.
Yeah. Assuming they manage to get their affairs in order in the next week, which... not likely. There's certainly room to outflank the NDP on a bunch of things here. And yeah.
That would actually set up a really interesting dynamic versus 2015, where you had Tom Mulcair run on arguably a more progressive overall platform. If you like dug into the details of what the NDP ran on in 2015 versus the Liberals. But the style and flavor of the two politicians compared definitely led a lot of people to say Mulcair feels more right wing. He talks too much about the deficit for a New Democrat. Trudeau talks a lot about progressive values and spending on new programs. He seems more left, even if the details didn't necessarily align. Here you could have Trudeau being the status quo, Jagmeet Singh representing a leftist change, even if the details aren't as radical or transformative as even parts of the Liberals' own mandate.
Yeah, and I can definitely see rooms for the... I don't think the Liberals are going to put altogether a more progressive or more left-wing platform than the NDP. There are definitely areas where they can pick out one or two things and really push ahead or make it bolder on something. On there, and as a result, I could see the Liberals adopting we're going to pick one or two big highlights and really hammer home on that. Yeah, it's interesting. Putting it out this early, I think, does also show the NDP's hand on their election strategy and kind of gives the other parties a little bit more time to figure out how they're going to combat it. So just a few other things that stuck out to me here. Not surprising, but disappointing to see from the NDP was that they want all their climate projects to use Canadian sourced steel and other materials, steel, aluminum, and other materials, which it is traditional NDP platform to apply a Buy a Canadian approach to everything. I'm sure if you were to look back in every platform they've ever put out, you'd probably find this. Nevertheless, it's not great. It increases the bureaucratic administrative hassles on actually implementing and building these projects. It raises costs for the projects themselves and makes it harder to actually get them implemented and built. And it just, I think, goes against this is an absolute crisis and we need to do everything we can to, you know, do what the IPCC says and limit warming to 1.5 degrees and all that. It's a little hard to do that, and also we're going to do a bunch of other things to, you know, try and pad out Canadian jobs and whatnot. If it's an existential crisis, getting the stuff built quickly and without needless resource expenditure is the thing you'd want to do. And it doesn't really come across in that when they do that sort of thing.
I don't think so. I won't necessarily defend a nationalistic purchasing policy per se, other than there have been highlights in the last year that having domestic production capacity in a variety of industries can prove very important very quickly, as we've learned. But
yeah, that actually is called out as a separate critical manufacturing stuff. And that was good to see there. And I expect every party is going to have some version of that platform. But yeah, the NDP definitely covered that off with a section on domestic vaccine and PPE production.
But what does come up in how do we address the climate crisis is this challenge that has been brought up a number of times, which is there are a lot of jobs we need to make obsolete very fast. Like most oil fossil fuel expansion jobs should not exist. And politically, and just even morally, telling a bunch of people you don't have jobs anymore, too bad, so sad, you shouldn't have gone into something that was clearly bad for the environment, is hard to swallow. And so finding ways to support growth in different and alternative sectors, even if they're still traditional manufacturing sectors like steel industry, can be a way to both politically get buy-in for that transition and also to just have places for people to work. And so the economy can keep growing and you don't just kneecap the country by shutting off the oil sands. You've at least created something, an alternative industry.
Yeah, but you're not likely to put in steel plant in northern Alberta to replace the oil sands or in Newfoundland. Either we have an established steel industry that isn't likely to be drastically expanded on that. It'll be good for, Hamilton and that part of Ontario where a lot of steel comes from, but you're probably not going to have oil sands workers suddenly manning the forges.
It's just my way of saying, if we're going to look at climate change, other issues do get bundled in, not just as extra things that could be done, but almost necessarily to be able to even accomplish the things. And it's a political debate of the time. We're running out of time, so whatever we need to do, we should do it. I'll just note that I just did the quickest search. I haven't read through it as thoroughly as I wish I could have, but the words Trans Mountain and natural gas do not appear in this platform at all. Not to say they're pro it or against it.
Yeah, they were a little vague on that.
Or they do reference a bitumen pipeline that the Liberal government bought.
Yeah, that was vague. What kind of clean energy alternatives they were interested in pursuing, that was vague, as was the infrastructure programs they want to see. There's talk about transit and that stuff, which would definitely be interest of our more urban listeners, but there's no details on what that actually would amount to. Does it mean we get new sky trains if the NDP somehow pull off a miracle and form government? Who knows? There's just a lot of vagueness in this all.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on the election as things get underway. I'm sure it will be exhausting, but at least we have the greatest BC Premier bracket to keep us entertained. We cover the federal election. Let's jump over to quick takes to start us off. The Special Committee to Review the Provisions of the Election Act has issued their report for the BC legislature. For those who don't remember, this is the MLAs deciding how much tax dollars should just be given to political parties by themselves.
Turns out the answer is about the amount we're already getting. So they recommend that the per vote subsidy be continued at be about $1.75 per vote in 2023, and then that it should be indexed to inflation moving forward.
And the idea would be to make the subsidy permanent to, quote, provide a stable and sustainable framework for funding ongoing activities by political parties. This is an interesting because it's, as far as I can tell, unanimous all-party consensus. You have the NDP, the Liberals, and the Greens all agreeing that, you know what, this money is actually pretty helpful, it turns out, for keeping your party afloat.
Parties like to have
and
money.
Like, to do it justice, and I do actually support this proposal, the challenge faced by political parties in the climate and the fundraising climate we've created is they're required to, you know, fundraise from members of the public, but they have a limit of $1,200 per person or $1,500 per person that they can fundraise. I don't remember what BC's is offhand because I get it confused with the federal one all the time.
It's around 1,200, and I think just also indexed to inflation, so it's a little, I'm a little off on where it's been now compared to where it was a couple years ago, but roughly in that 1,200 to 1,500.
And so range. Federally, we had a per vote subsidy for quite a while, but the Harper government famously got rid of it in 2008. And that was one of the seeds of the prorogation crisis of that year when all the other parties said, we like getting paid. But one thing you see when you don't have this is parties really need to appeal to the common denominator of their base. Like you see the Federal Conservative Party get really good at fundraising from the same pool of donors. It's a large pool, granted, but it's a more extreme pool than the average member of the public and the average voter. And so the party dissociates from where I think Canadians are in chasing for the dollar, the almighty dollar. One of the big things with online fundraising, and you see this especially on platforms like Rebel Media, is outrage generates more donations and more fundraising than making the argument that you will present a moderate to stable, reasonable government. It's, no, these other guys are evil and we're the only ones who will vanquish them. Give us $10. And that can be bad for politics and the discourse over the long term. And so having some alternative funding source that isn't tied to outrage politics can hopefully discourage that.
Yeah, that is definitely one of my concerns with kind of the evolution of Canadian political fundraising. I know we've talked about it quite a bit before, and I think it was only like an episode or two ago, I basically laid out the exact same points. So yeah, it's definitely an area I'm concerned about. Nevertheless, there's always been something about you funneling taxpayer money into kind of political operations that has never entirely sat right with me. This isn't a, I'm going to check a box on my tax return to pay into the voting fund, which then gets distributed on a per vote basis. Like every British Columbian's money is going into this, and it is paying for parties that they don't support or may even find repulsive. And it's, you know, there's something about that that's, even with those other concerns, that doesn't entirely feel right.
Yeah, there's no perfect system. Parties have become a major part of our electoral system. They're not fully written into constitution or legislation, but they exist and they operate. And as we've discussed in the nonpartisan premier bracket part, our governments don't work without political parties. And so we do need to, I think, accept that they will be here for quite a while, even if the kind of parties change. The committee had a ton of submissions. They had 103 written submissions, 11 in person. 8 of those in-person submissions and 70 of those written ones favored keeping the subsidy, with a lot of those supporting raising it to $2.50 per vote. A much smaller portion, just 36 submissions in total, opposed the subsidy. So it was, that's not to say anything about the strength of the arguments any of those submissions presented, but people who like the idea of supporting political parties did manage to get their voice in there. And I don't know how widely viewed that is. I imagine the average voter or my random neighbors would share that hesitancy and that unease that you set out. And part of that's even in this report with the fact that they don't really require any transparency from the political parties who will be getting this subsidy.
Yeah.
Granted, the party would just move the money around and be like, yeah, we spent the subsidy money on the good things and we spent our own money on the bad things. But
yeah, put your office staff or something on the public subsidy and then use your political shenanigan funds from your donors and that. There's an element of money being fungible here that makes it pretty easy to go around and skirt the rules on that or find a way to report the public funding in the most favorable light.
But in any case, it looks like the per vote subsidy is here to stay for at least a bit longer, probably until the next political party to knock the NDP out decides it's in their political favor to abolish it. Because politics is in everything.
Well, moving on to our next story. BC is finally getting on the mandatory vaccination train, at least in one very small part, as public health officer and Minister Dix today announced that COVID-19 vaccinations will be mandatory for workers in assisted living and long-term care.
Was the lowest bar?
Why was it not the case before? Why do the rules not take effect until October 12th? So they earlier this week also dropped the time between vaccinations on first and second dose down to 28 days. And doing the math, October 12th is more than 28 days away, even adding an extra week in there to, you know, let people book their first doses, which I think now are actually doing walk-ins. So why slow walk to this? Why wasn't it already the case? And why only healthcare workers or workers in long-term care homes? Because I would put a fair bit of money on those two coming back to the podium in a week or two, maybe a little longer, to announce some other slice of BC will also be requiring vaccinations. My money's on teachers, but that's probably not going to be until like 3 weeks into the school year when there's some Delta outbreaks and then everybody's angry and the province is yet again being reactive rather than proactive on this stuff. And I just don't get why they're doing this in such like a piecemeal fashion when if you look ahead with even a little bit of knowledge on how the pandemic's gone till date, they'll be announcing something else.
So
later.
I think the delay till October is one of those concessions you have to make to keep it charter compliant, to give people a reasonable opportunity. Like we could quibble and say maybe it could be 2 weeks sooner, but a month or two is necessary given people need to get the one vaccine in the next, say, week to 10 days. And then, because it's not always as simple as just, oh, I can get it tomorrow, because not all of the clinics are super convenient for all of the people in the province. Even granting that you're supposed to get paid leave to go and get your vaccine, you still have to request that. And so then you get your first vaccine, then you need 4 weeks, then you can get your second vaccine appointment, but that might take another week or two. Fine. We're into October, but everyone needs to have it by then. They did also announce or allude to the fact that healthcare workers are going to be required to start reporting their vaccination status, which seems to be like a hint that they're going to move there for the broader healthcare system, which wouldn't be surprising. I wonder how much negotiating is going on behind the scenes with unions. I would be shocked if they required it of teachers. Not that the BCTF is an anti-vax union, but just
they're strong. Ontario,
and fighting teachers would be BC tradition, but
yeah, and I think it would be a winning move for the BC NDP on this, because we saw what happened when Andrea Horvath paid even a little lip service to where the Ontario teachers unions were on this and got absolutely destroyed and had to walk it back within, what, a day? It is very easy to score political points and be on the winning side of this one where the government.
But I guess the bigger question is, what's the best public health position rather than how do you best win political points? And
everybody in the province has to get vaccinated.
There's a lot of academics who don't think a broad sweeping mandate is a necessarily successful strategy. Like it will create backlash. So doing piecemeal sectors is probably what we're just going to see. I don't know which ones are next.
I am not sold on that. It would create a big backlash. Everything I've seen to date suggests that playing to the anti-vax crowd is going to create a bigger backlash than anything to do to get people that sedated. There is a BC's what, above 80% first dose and around what, high 60s, low 70s?
We're past 70s second dose. Second doses now of the eligible to be vaccinated population.
Yeah. The overwhelming percent of BC both is vaccinated, thinks vaccinations are a good idea, and is, I don't have polling data on this, but just watching things, annoyed that we're in a fourth wave because people aren't getting vaccinated, and between the backlash to we're going into another round of restrictions to pander to the anti-vaxxers because we won't just make them get vaccinated, is going to be much more of a backlash generator than, yeah, that 20% that are being a bunch of selfish idiots. They have to go get vaccinated if they want to, you know, do anything at all in society.
We'll see where we go. We're seeing more and more calls from it. There's a Globe and Mail op-ed, yes to vaccine mandates, yes to vaccine passports. We're also still facing a variant that, by all accounts, yes, you're still better off vaccinated than not vaccinated, but we're seeing more headlines of there's no real herd immunity level to the, or sufficient vaccination level for the Delta variant. Like, it's not even 90% fully vaccinated. It's 99% fully vaccinated, and the other 1% have had COVID. And then you're mostly fine to it. So we're in weird, scary spot as well. That's not to say we shouldn't push more vaccines, but I feel like we keep losing sight of all of the other tools in our toolbox because we get obsessed with the vaccines.
On the vaccines, they're still quite successful at preventing severe cases. There's definitely a much higher rate of symptomatic but non-severe cases. You're seeing more of those breakthroughs, and there is some indication that it's less effective against preventing spread. Nevertheless, so far from what I've seen on the rate of severe cases is less than the flu would be if among the vaccinated. So if you're vaccinated and you catch COVID, you're in less danger than if you caught the flu, which has been a comparison that was made a lot incorrectly earlier on, but in the case of people fully vaccinated against and exposed to Delta, does seem to hold. At some point, we do have to move on to this, because the option to eradicate the virus seems to have passed at this point, and it's probably going to be endemic, and at some point, that does mean we're going to have to find a way to return to normal life with it around, and vaccines certainly seem to be the best way of doing it rather than continued social restrictions, particularly with the, if they can tweak the mRNA vaccines to provide targeted immunity against the Delta variant in a booster shot, which may be coming soon, one would hope, but that would also need to obviously be paired with an expansion of vaccine production worldwide, because we are not hitting the requirements to get everywhere else vaccinated.
The good news there is Canada is looking to build a Moderna vaccine plant, finally, with some federal cash, as it was announced this week.
Yeah, so Philippe Champagne announced that earlier this week. Good.
Maybe it'll be ready in time for the pandemic after the next one.
With the way things are going, I think it's more likely than not we'll be for quite a while, possibly indefinitely, we'll be getting annual booster shots. And in that case, having increased production capacity and domestic production capacity would be really good. Also, the mRNA technology looks like it's going to be a kind of generally applicable or more general technology platform, which is super promising because they're already doing trials against, I think, cancer, malaria, and a few other serious diseases that would be great if we could A, have much more effective therapies against, and B, produce them in Canada. And yeah, if it takes a little cash from the federal government, this is probably one of those times where I can put aside my general resistance to corporate subsidies.
And just to close off, back in the news, it's not the wood chipper, but it's the wood chipper's best friend, former BC Sergeant at Arms, Gary Lenz, is in the news as the British Columbia Prosecution Service has concluded that they will not be recommending charges against Lenz. As we've discussed quite a while ago, Craig James, the former speaker, who Lenz was
clerk.
Craig James, the former clerk, who was publicly escorted with Lenz out of the legislature quite unceremoniously in November 2018. James is facing charges, a number of breach of trust and fraud over $5,000. But Lenz has denied wrongdoing. There was a report kind of fingering Lenz, but to his good luck and good fortune, he can retire in relative peace now. He won't be going to jail.
Yeah, so that report, the one referenced in the story, did conclude that he was not entirely truthful when it came to some of the statements, but didn't explicitly find kind of the same evidence of wrongdoing that was found against James.
It's amazing how much this story has just like completely gone out of our memory. Like the James...
No Daryl Plekis.
Yeah, no Daryl Plekis. The James trial is still ongoing, but other than that, it's almost over. We can almost put...
I don't think the James trial started yet. I think they've just had their... What's it called? Their preliminary hearing type of thing. But I don't think there's actually had a trial yet.
Yeah, I think you're right. Once the trial is before the court, I'm sure we'll get a nice spectacle for that. But yeah, we spent so long talking about wood chippers and all the fun things several years ago.
So we're almost at the end of it. I think this is probably the final story where we'll be talking about Gary Lenz. But no doubt in the coming year or so, we'll be discussing the James trial.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.